That's the Kenny Drew Quintet with Groovin' the Blues. Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Hank Mobley, tenor sax, the great Kenny Drew himself on piano, Sam Jones on bass, and Louis Hayes on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Thursday, March the 7th. And it seems that President Barack Obama indeed has gotten the point that he has, in fact, been smacked down by the Republicans, no doubt about it. It's fair warning that he needs to get his act together, but can he? That's the question. The president appears to have more political burdens than he reasonably could handle. He's got a continuing checkmate in Congress, a ragtag cabinet with no sense of direction yet, a budget and economy woes that are pending and are multiplying by the minute, and even factionalism within the Democratic Party, of which he is the titular head. But first, let's get back to that appeasement. It comes in the form of a menu that the Republicans have been serving, and the first appetizer course, I should say, was served yesterday by Rand Paul. The Republicans are going to be going through a series of menu items that would cause the president to do one thing before the entire nation, before the entire world, and that is he's got to eat lots of crow, which is the entree, followed by hefty portions of humble pie. Rand Paul, the Republican senator from Kentucky and a Tea Party favorite, served up the appetizer, as I said, in the form of an old-fashioned filibuster of the confirmation of John Brennan, President Obama's nominee for CIA director. Here's how he served it up.
I rise today to begin to filibuster John Brennan's nomination for the CIA. I will speak until I can no longer speak. I will speak as long as it takes until the alarm is sounded from coast to coast that our Constitution is important, that your rights to trial by jury are precious, that no American should be killed by a drone on American soil without first being charged with a crime, without first being found to be guilty by a court, that Americans could be killed in a cafe in San Francisco or in a restaurant in Houston or at their home in Bowling Green, Kentucky, is an abomination. It is something that should not and cannot be tolerated in our country. I don't rise to oppose John Brennan's nomination simply for the person. I rise today for the principle. The principle is one that as Americans we have fought long and hard for, and to give up on that principle, to give up on the Bill of Rights, to give up on the Fifth Amendment protection that says that no person shall be held without due process, that no person shall be held for a capital offense without being indicted. This is a precious American tradition and something we should not give up on easily. They say Lewis Carroll is fiction. Alice never fell down a rabbit hole, and the White Queen's caustic judgments are not really a threat to your security. Or has America the Beautiful become Alice's Wonderland? No, no, said the Queen. Sentence first, verdict afterwards. Stuff and nonsense, Alice said loudly. The idea of having the sentence first? Hold your tongue, said the Queen, turning purple. I won't, said Alice. Release the drones, said the Queen, as she shouted at the top of her voice. Lewis Carroll is fiction, right? When I asked the president, can you kill an American on American soil? It should have been an easy answer. It's an easy question. It should have been a resounding and unequivocal no. The president's response? He hasn't killed anyone yet. We're supposed to be comforted by that. The president says, I haven't killed anyone yet. He goes on to say, and I have no intention of killing Americans, but I might. Is that enough? Are we satisfied by that? Are we so complacent with our rights that we would allow a president to say he might kill Americans, but he will judge the circumstances?
Well, that was a 13-hour course, a 13-hour first course that ended literally this morning. I wonder if you picked up the significance of that. It's not just the literal meaning of what he's saying, but bear in mind that he's focusing on the constitutional questions involved. And what he's saying indirectly is, here's a president who is a trained constitutional lawyer, who himself and his administration, via the Attorney General Eric Holder, simply refuse to obey the Constitution. This is a strong point, and it's hard to argue against it. And here is Rand Paul sounding rather statesmanlike. He has taken away the authority of the president, and he sounds more like a president than the president does. He is, in fact, schooling the president on constitutional law. He says this is a fundamental question. It should be easy to answer. Can you legally kill a United States citizen on American soil? Drones. Can you do this unilaterally without any qualification? This should be an easy answer. There's no doubt that Barack Obama has left his flank open on this question. And the unwillingness or inability of his administration to deal squarely with these matters is what has made him vulnerable. And so Rand Paul, who you can tell from the tone of that, that it will come in nicely when and if he declares his candidacy for president in 2016, that he gave a lesson in constitutional law to the constitutional expert in the White House on fundamental constitutional rights. That is very heavy stuff. But that was a 13-hour course, first course. Here's how it ended.
And I would go for another 12 hours to try to break Strom Thurmond's record, but I've discovered that there are some limits to filibustering, and I'm going to have to go take care of one of those in a few minutes here. But I do appreciate the Senate's forbearance in this, and I hope that if there are some on the other side of the aisle who have been listening and feel that they may agree on some of these issues, that they will use their ability to impact the president's decision, and one will say that the Senate should be trying to restrain the executive branch, Republican or Democrat. And two, we'll use your influence to try to tell the president to do what I think really is in his heart, and that is to say, absolutely, we're not going to be killing Americans, not in a combat situation, that we will obey the Constitution, that the Fifth Amendment does apply to all Americans, and there aren't exceptions. But I thank you very much for the forbearance, and I yield the floor.
Mr. President.
Senator from Illinois.
Well, that sounded extremely statesmanlike, very, very impartial, very humane, as a matter of fact. He took great care to say this was not a personal attack at all on the president. He is standing for the Constitution, which is bigger than he himself and bigger than Barack Obama. but that we have to live by the law. Now, this is the big point. The big point is, and I pointed this out several times, this particular administration has taken great pains, it seems, to make itself unlikable because of its arrogance and because of its smugness and because it took on the aura of, hey, we don't have to talk to anybody. We don't have to consult with anybody. We do what we want to do. And we're smart. And Obama literally gave his political enemies and adversaries the ammunition to mow him down. He's thinking that it's about points that you make. No, it's about the character of your administration. And if you are in your second term and you're into legacy building, you behave like you understand the stature of your office. But that's not what's coming from this White House. I talked about that time and again. You don't make points by investing so much in being unlikable and arrogant and aloof and smug that you are so smart, you literally have outsmarted yourself. And that's why I said these guys, you think they've been around the block several times. And they watch a young Obama coming into the presidency, in their view, quite prematurely. And they expected a certain degree of recognition in terms of the diplomacy that one expects between the White House and Congress. And that is a deference. That doesn't make you powerless. It doesn't make you beneath them. It is about saying, this is what democracy is. There are certain duties that only the president has. There are certain duties that only Congress has. But there are certain duties that they both share. And you can't pick and choose. You play by the rules, but you play smart. That's not what Obama did. I want to elucidate on this point because it's very important. Barack Obama, I've referred to as a managed president, a manufactured president. This is not to suggest that he doesn't have the basics. He doesn't qualify academically. Not at all. He has the basics. He's as qualified as anybody else who's been president. And in some cases, even more so. But there has to be a recognition that his presidency was also a confluence of interests. Yes, it's about political ambition, but it is also about a group of people who saw the efficacy of utilizing this person to achieve a whole different set of aims and objectives. I'm saying that there is an inner circle. Barack Obama has facilitated the formation of an inner circle, and even he doesn't recognize that he's not in it. He's the reason for the formation of an inner circle in his government. It's a government within a government, and he's not in it. The people who are in it, and you can tell who they are, have seen to it that within the first 4 years of his administration, they ensconced themselves and entrenched themselves in strategically important positions, particularly where money and policy, foreign policy, are concerned. That's the power. They did such a good job of it that beginning 2 years ago, they went on to those interests and have left him to battle it out. I mean, they got him up and into the office. They have the science and the knowledge of that machinery. So Obama doesn't own that. He is the agency of that, but they own the science. They own the knowledge. They spun off his machine into another endeavor. And that endeavor is another money machine and influence machine that will keep them very handsomely employed and will keep them connected in strategic ways with this administration and administrations beyond it. Just today, the Organization for Action, as it's now called, it used to be the Organization for Obama, that was the machinery that got him the incredible juggernaut that got this relatively new guy in national politics, just took him up and put him in the White House. They were accused of essentially disguising their intention, and they were accused of using this new entity, which Obama spun off and put them in charge of, as a way of merchandising their proximity to power. So now they're defending the state. Well, why are you accepting corporate donations? Why are you accepting money from strange interests if you're a nonprofit? And they said today, just today, oh, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to accept any more money from corporate interests. So what did they do? They now have a new thing that they formed that can accept money from corporate interests, a separate entity, but they still control it. This is what I mean. Barack Obama thinks he is in charge, and he isn't. He's left to deal with the fallout, but he is a managed president. Nobody should be, I mean, somebody this accomplished, having accomplished so much, should be wrestling with these details, apparently almost by himself. He's almost by himself fighting now, because they've moved on. They've got other interests. It was nice while it lasted, but now they really have to deal with their own specific interests, money interests and influence interests. I come back to the theme. When a president understands he has power, he doesn't have to flaunt it the way Obama did. That suggests right away that you are uneasy with it. You're unfamiliar with power. You're not comfortable handling it. You don't have to run around the country and make all that noise. You don't have to have all these dog and pony shows to affirm what you should know intuitively, that you have the power. You're not renting it. People gave it to you. So you move assertively, but not in a confrontational way. They don't care whether he is abrasive. In fact, I think they like the idea because that's who they are. They are abrasive. Because by sheer abrasiveness, they have been able to borrow their way through all this labyrinthine stuff that they have to go through to rise to the top. Because, by the way, they are not nearly as good as they ought to be. A couple of them are very good. But most of the people that Obama has facilitated as being influential now on the national and international scene are really painfully average people. Their advantage is in the quality of their connections, The advantage is in the ability to decide where they're going to land and take advantage of a network that would land them there. That's what's so extraordinary about these people. And those are the kinds of people that surround the president. But hey, he has made his deal with them. You get me where I want to go, and I'll help you get whatever it is you want done. Which is why our president stood up and talked about one of his goals, he said, is to restore Nancy Pelosi to the House leadership. As if that's a good thing. She's a disaster. But that is the kind of subservience that bothers me and troubles me about Barack Obama. In all of these talks that he's giving, in all of these meetings that he's having, the marked absence of the Black caucus is troubling. The marked absence of the Latino caucus is troubling. The marked absence of the organizations that represent the bulk of his political base is troubling. It tells me that we have a president with some serious focus issues. He can't tell what's really important, or it doesn't register on him that these are the people who are of value. The other folks are simply there for what it is they can get out of him. And again, I assert that they were so skillful that they have actually created an inner circle, and he, the president, is not in it. He doesn't get that yet. He doesn't get that yet. They are transacting business that he doesn't even know about. And he has to ask permission to come in. He's not invited in. Part of the deal is the science and the knowledge, that's not your affair. You got what you wanted, which is we fulfilled your political ambitions to get where you wanted to go. The trade-off is now we get to do what we need to do. And what we need to do, well, you know, you can't really be a part of it. Because this is a closed situation. Or as they say in the hood, a situation. It's a closed situation, brother. You're not part of it. Now, you get to go out there and you get to explain the Democratic Party. You get to explain these economic decisions. You get to explain the constitutional law. You get to deal with all of the fallout. If we can help you, we will. But right now, we are no longer in your administration helping you to do these things. We have moved on. You get to figure it out. Rand Paul's action yesterday, and we have to see it for what it is, but it was extraordinarily symbolic and meaningful and actually a shattering thing to happen politically. He took all the thunder. He took all the energy. With that one action, he restored focus where they want it. And the focus is, if you're reading between the lines, and I keep saying we have to read all the layers, what he is saying in effect is, under this man, this country is going to hell. Under this man, there is no rule or respect for law at the highest levels. And I am standing here today before all America, before the entire world, pleading for a renegade president to toe the line. And the things that you see us doing that may seem a bit irregular, these are the only weapons we have to engage in an appeal to the president not to ruin things. That's the message. We are doing all these desperate things, these desperate acts that we are committing by holding up appointments. We don't want to do that. We think John Brennan is a nice guy. But this is not about the nice guy. The larger issue here is we have a renegade government. And we cannot continue to entrust the welfare of the entire country to somebody like this, who cannot observe even the basics of the law. That's the message. That's a very powerful message. You can't argue with it. But it appears that Barack Obama has decided that it's time for him to eat some crow. And he's got to eat copious amounts of it. He's already genuflected before them yesterday. He invited a dozen of them, a dirty dozen, to dinner. And it's beginning to make nice. And what he's saying is, I understand. I understand the error of my ways. Could we kind of, you know, fix things up? Could we make a deal? Can't we all just get along? And that's the realization is this. The realization is he is running out of time and he's running out of ammunition. His term, his last term in office, will soon be over. And he's begging and pleading now, give me something that I could say was my legacy. Give me something to work with. That's where he is right now. That's where the Republicans have him. Oh, they did a masterful job. Give me something. What can we do? I will do what I can to make you look good. You do what you can to make me look good. We both know, as I said yesterday, the message that is next with respect to where the cuts will go, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, they both are on the same page. There's no ideological difference right now between the Republicans and the Democrats. They're on the same page. What they're fighting for and what they're fighting about is who will have to take on the burden of letting the folks know. Because whoever lets the folks know, those people or that person or that party will be responsible and will be permanently attached to some of the worst news to come down the pike since the Great Depression. The dishonesty of Barack Obama is that he knows, because he is following the Clintonian edict coming out of the Democratic Leadership Council, which is, you look like a liberal, but you are a raging conservative. And in the same way that Clinton, quote, changed welfare as we know it when he was elected back then, this is in Barack Obama's mind what he also has to do. What's pressing on him as well, he is to be grateful, to show gratitude to the party. That is to say, the white power structure within the party, for the opportunity not only to serve as president, but hopefully to remain in their good graces once he has left. The quid pro quo is he has got to get all these Democrats who want to be in office and to remain in office. He's got to raise the money. He's got to see the best way possible to make the Democratic Party the majority party of the House. That's a huge burden on him. Oh, they're going to make him work. He is going to work like a Nubian. He is going to work like 10 mules before he leaves office. He will earn everything that they give up to him, even though he deserved it. But if he had conducted himself in a different way, he'd get that easily. He'd get it easily. So he has that issue. The factionalism now within the party, the black members of the caucus that he's been ignoring since he got in, are facing re-election, and they are representing distressed constituencies, every single one of them. They are going to tear this president apart if he should do the bidding of the Democratic Leadership Council type of orientation and say, all right, we're going to cut these programs severely. There will be hell to pay. And they're getting ready. They're mumbling loudly now. They're getting ready to have open fights with him. He has ignored them. He doesn't talk to them. He doesn't accept their advice and counsel. And he pretends like they're all Ralph Ellison. They're all invisible. But he has to cut. And he doesn't know how to frame this thing. The Republicans are not going to take the initiative to announce bad news. They're going to make him do it. They're going to make him do it. I'm watching to see how the smart Harvard-educated president manages to avoid the inevitability of things. So we have those things happening. We have also, while the situation looks like it's fracturing around him, he's lost his bearings. He seems not to have the kind of support that he needs to make sensible decisions. He makes decisions. They're not necessarily sensible. But while all of this is happening on his end, the Republicans, who just a blink of an eye ago were in tatters, they're beginning to getting second wind. And they only can do that because they understand that their adversary is up the wall. They have him against the wall. They have him pinned. They smacked him down. And they're building momentum. And they're building appeal. I mean, if you were to just listen to Rand Paul, you say, well, my God, thank goodness there's some rational person in Congress. This guy sounds perfectly reasonable, perfectly likable, perfectly sensible, perfectly American. You can't get more American sounding than that. What are the Democrats saying? Oh, it's the Republicans. Hey, you know, that's a tired argument, and it doesn't tell us anything. This administration has never presented, so far, it's not presented any cogent, intelligible plans. It's not telling people what's happening because it's cloak and dagger stuff, and it's lies, and it's, you know, misrepresentations, and, you know, Obama says one day, oh, well, you know, I love the sequester, and the next day he's talking about, hey, we can't have the sequester. One day he's saying, yes, we initiated it. Next day he's saying, well, the Republicans are doing it. Come on. This is not governing. This is not governance at all. It's, you know, playing games, little games. So, our president yesterday was served up a copious amount of crow, and he's eating it. They're going to make him eat it, followed by nice fat slices of humble pie. You will tell the nation in so many words that you have been slammed. You will publicly say an act of contrition for being uncooperative, for being haughty, for being a renegade, for not listening to reason. And he's going to do that. Because I think he is alone. And the people around him, the people he should have around him, are no longer there. Not no longer there, they never were there. The people who used to be around him are now taking care of their own affairs. They're putting their money-making machines together. And they're hurrying up because time is closing in on them. This president, in the blink of an eye, would be out of office. Now, mind you, I'm very much aware of the racism factor because, as I said, these things are so obvious I seldom even raise them because I assume that they are part of the landscape. We understand all of the racist layers of meaning in this whole debacle. And there, too, is a discussion about what is possibly going through this president's mind. The disturbing evidence that repeatedly he seems uncomfortable about embracing himself within a cultural context with which he feels perfectly comfortable. But there's a certain elemental dishonesty about Mr. Obama. And it comes from the fact that I think his confidence, I mean, he's not anchored in himself. So he feels a need constantly to prove his mettle, even when there's no need to. He feels always subservient. And as educated as he is, one worries about what is it that keeps him grounded? Is he likely, can he be counted on to be absolutely faithful to his constituencies? And we've seen the pattern that says, no, you cannot depend on Barack Obama to be your constant defender. It ain't gonna happen. He's a man whose allegiances shift. They shift with the wind. They shift according to the moment and the expediency of the moment. He has not fully matured in that sense politically. To say, for example, like a Harold Washington out of Chicago, I'm a black man, I love it. You want to fight on any level, I'm ready. Let's go. Because I am comfortable in my own skin, and I am faithful, and I understand my allegiance to the constituency that is depending on me to change things for them. And that's, we talked about yesterday with respect to Hugo Chavez. The media keeps reporting all the time, oh, here's a group of people who are crying. They're crying in the streets. They're beating their chest. They're falling to the ground. They're in tears. They're in absolute distress over his death. And they can't figure that out. And then there's another group over here, and they're dancing in the streets because he's dead. And they can't see that the group that is falling on the ground and beating their chests, the group that feels completely despondent, they look like Chavez. The group that isn't doesn't look like Chavez. And they can't figure that story out. They're reporting on it, but they can't figure it out. Hugo Chavez said proudly, African blood is in my veins. Mestizo blood is in my veins. Original blood is in my veins. I embrace them all. And his record showed that he was faithful to his obligation, as he saw it, to the poorest of the poor, not just in Venezuela, but throughout the Caribbean. We heard the story about Haiti, how he came to Haiti with sanitation trucks, with doctors, support for doctors, and all these things that Venezuela, they're saying now, oh, Venezuela's economy is in tatters. Well, look, here's the way you look at the story. The story is, okay, you want to say Venezuela's economy is in tatters? What do you say then of a country whose economy is in tatters? And even so, is able to help other countries in the surrounding region. What do you say about that? Isn't that an extraordinary accomplishment? So, watch Mr. Obama and watch the lesson as it unfolds. This is a very historic moment. It doesn't look like it, but it is, because it intends to teach us something. And all kinds of things. This is what my father would call a curious concatenation of events. All different separate component parts are coming together in this. The racial aspect, politics, the whole business of inner circles and governments within governments, the lessons of how it is a government ought to work, the meanings of things that look so no big deal, but they're big deals. Keep that in mind, because it will shape the immediate future for Barack Obama and everybody else. But I hope this president has understood the meaning of the moment. I hope that he has understood that it is meant to reconnect him to his constituencies. I hope that it has made him understand the importance of that connection and the importance of the historical moment. It is not about you, Mr. Obama. It's not about you. The historical moment belongs to the people who put you there. You don't get that. You think people do things for you because of who you are. They do things for you because of who they are. You don't get that. That's a huge difference. People are doing things for you because of who they are. Understand that, and then you understand the reason for you being elected in the first place. We will monitor Mr. Obama as he digests his meal of crow and humble pie. We will see whether he draws any nutrients from that. We'll see whether it causes him to rethink his position and correct for the next 4 years, because the clock is ticking, time is going by. Well, I want to thank you so much for indulging me in this lecture today, but these points have to be made, I think. I don't assume, you know, that I'm necessarily more important than anybody else's opinions, that mine is more important than yours. But, you know, there are things that need to be said. And, of course, you always will have the opportunity to respond. We'll make the room for that, because I really do value a dialogue as opposed to a monologue. I like the idea of people instructing me as well. I learn so much. But we have to begin to talk about these things openly and bravely. And not with bad intention, but we can't also ignore the reality of the situation, which does not look good. We can't pretend that it is good if it doesn't look good. And we're not saying these things in a mean-spirited way. We're saying this because of genuine concern, not about Barack Obama, but because Barack Obama, for the moment, is the agent through which we have been expecting change. We hold him accountable for that. We hold him to respond accordingly. And if he doesn't, it is our obligation to let him know. So thank you very much for allowing me to say these words today and, you know, to give voice to a very unsettling scenario. We're witnessing it. It's happening in slow motion. And you know, you get the feeling of watching the thing unfold and you're unable to change it. You're unable to have impact on it. So at the very least, let's pretend that we can have impact by talking about it publicly. Let's hope that it somehow reaches his ear and or reaches the ear of someone who is in a position to tell him, hey, you need to rethink this whole thing. You really do. You can certainly reach me to continue the conversation at lead stories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. I'm also on Facebook. I'm getting used to this Facebook thing. I didn't know that I could actually manage it, but I'm trying my best. It looks like I'm getting to make it work. So you can reach me on Facebook as well. And I want to thank you sincerely for the pleasure and privilege of your company. I feel privileged to have an audience like you. You're very, very concerned people. You're thinking people. And you're brave people because we have matured, I think. I sense this generally. We have matured to the point where we can engage in these kinds of conversations without anybody taking anything personally or being offended. We see that we're tackling an issue and not really tackling a person. All right. If you want to stay tuned right here at PRN.FM, because coming up next is Mike Fader with Occupied Territory. And I want to give you an assignment. The assignment is, in your spheres of influence, the people that you interact with on a daily basis, your job is to recruit them to listen to PRN.FM and to join this particular family on PRN.FM so that we can have a community of interest and we can begin to build on that. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company. Let's see each other tomorrow. Thanks.